The divine guide, Athena as Mentor, was the keynote speech given by Heidi White at the 2025 Gutenberg Education Conference, titled Teacher as Mentor. Heidi White is a teacher, editor, podcaster, and author. She teaches humanities at St. Hild's School in Colorado Springs and is the author of The Divided Soul, Reuniting Duty and Desire in Literature and Life. She is a contributing author, speaker, consultant, and atrium instructor at the Searcy Institute, and a weekly contributor on fiction, poetry, and Shakespeare on the Close Reads podcast network. She serves on the board of directors of the Anselm Society and the Academic Advisory Board for the Classical Learning Test. She writes fiction, poetry, and essays, and she speaks about literature, education, and the Christian imagination. She lives in Black Forest, Colorado, with her husband and children. We hope you enjoy this presentation.
Thank you so much. I've never been to Eugene, so this is exciting. I texted my friend Andrea, who was here last year. If you were here last year, you know her. And I was like, tell me about this conference. And she sent me just the kindest text. I wish I had it right in front of me. I wasn't planning on saying this, but she's like, this is a conference that actually lives out classical education, and it's doing the thing, not just talking about the thing, and it's true. So very, very grateful to be here. Thank you to Elliot and Chris and to everybody at Gutenberg. You guys have a really special community and a really, really special staff. So I'm honored to be here. So one thing that wasn't in my bio, and I didn't add that because I wanted to tell you myself, is I just got a new title at my school. I've been the academic director at the school that I work at in Colorado Springs for a couple years now, but I'm just moving over to a new role, and my new title is mentoring director. So that was unknown to anybody in this room because I literally just got that title like 2 weeks ago. But I'm really excited about it. So this is something that actually is on my heart that I'm thinking a lot about what it means to be a mentor and to have a mentoring role in people's lives, which is not something any of us should take lightly. Mentors have, mentors have a tremendous influence. And so it's not about authority, it's not about power, it means something really, really important. And so I don't take the title of this conference and the ideas of this conference lightly. So I'm going to tell you first, I'm going to be talking tonight about the Odyssey, but I want to tell you a story about my son. He's 19 now. He's about to leave for college again. It just keeps happening. But he's always been a very thoughtful kind of kid, deep waters kind of thing. I have one like that, and then I have another one who's like, ah! So it's not about, those are the things you can't give your children. They just have them. Like, they're born that way, right? When Jack was about, I don't know, 9, 10, kind of middle kid years, I walked into his room one night, and he was sitting cross-legged on his bed, it's a little, like, Pottery Barn quilt, with a copy of The Odyssey in his lap opened. It was the actual Odyssey. We had read the children's version, like, a million times. He knew the story, but he had pulled this copy of it off of my shelf. He lasted like 3 pages. He's not like a prodigy, but he was just opening it, reading it, and like really thoughtfully. And I kind of just like, you know, that's one of those moments that you're like, don't break the bubble because this is not going to last, right? So I just like stood there and watched him. And he looked up and he made eye contact with me, and he said, Telemachus just said, does any man ever really know his father? He's like, do you think that's true? I was like, I don't know. I don't know if that's true. Right? But that is the kind of question, the kind of relationship that Telemachus had with Athena. When you can ask those kinds of questions, that's a mentor. So I'm going to tell you a little bit about Athena and Telemachus's relationship, give you a little bit of background on the Odyssey. If you're familiar with this, this will be a retelling, and you can just relax and enjoy having a story told to you after dinner. Doing, like, after dinner speaking, I will tell you this, like, little inside baseball, it's like hit or miss, right? So it's like after lunch, like when you've got that 1 o'clock slot or the 4 o'clock slot or the after dinner slot, right? It's either great or you're just like, everybody's falling asleep. Is it me? You know? I'm just going to tell you some stories. And you can just maybe don't fall asleep because it'll hurt my feelings. But yeah. All right. So the Odyssey was written down, at least, probably as from a long oral tradition before it was actually written down. In the 7th or 8th century, so like a long time, probably around the time that like King David was walking on the earth, around that kind of time, Bronze Age, so like a very, very long time ago, long before the world into which Christ was born, or the stories of the history of the time of Christ, the life of Christ, long before that. But commentators throughout the ages until now have noticed and commented on the allegory of the Christian life that is embedded within the narrative story of the Odyssey. If for those of you familiar, right, so I'll just give you one example. Odysseus gets washed up on an island with a monster, the Cyclops, right, who takes him with his men and locks him into a cave for how long? 3 days, right? And on the third day, he breaks himself free, rolls the stone away, right, carries his men off. And the last thing that he says to the monster is to declare his name to him. I am Odysseus. This is for those of us who are Christians, this is a very familiar story, right? How did Homer know this? How did the Greeks know this? This is one of the things that's so fascinating about being a classics kind of person, is when you can identify these patterns, these stories that over the ages we can't help but tell. Right, we're talking today about the Minos. Socrates called this kind of thing recollection. When you're remembering something eternal, this recognition of the image of God in us, the image is tarnished, but it is there, right? And the world around us is fallen, but we still long for the true story and recognize it, and we write it into the stories that we tell, without knowing what we're writing. It's powerful, powerful. So this is particularly true in this epic. So let me give you the problem of the story of the Odyssey. Well, one of the problems, the main problem perhaps, is this is Odysseus's absence from home. If you have taught this book or read this book before, you know one of the questions that comes up is, why don't we get to meet Odysseus until book 5? Right, like where is the guy? We begin at his homeland, Ithaca, and he's been gone from home for 20 years. And some people feel like these first couple of books of the Odyssey kind of drag on, but I'm going to try to give you a different perspective on this, one for yourself and one you could potentially offer for your students. So the problem with the story is that Odysseus is gone, and he is the Lord. He is the king. And he is absent from his homeland, and they need him. They need him. They need him personally. They also need him in a political sense, because without him, the country is very, very unstable. And in his absence, Odysseus has left behind a wife named Penelope, who is in every way equal to her husband. She is a prodigious leader in her own right, and incredibly intelligent. She's often called wise, quiet, circumspect Penelope. But in the case of his absence, she is a woman in a man's world. stranded and surrounded by dangers and temptations. And these dangers and temptations come in the form of suitors who have moved into the palace to try to win her hand. Now, they're not trying very hard to win her hand. Mostly they're trying to drink all of Odysseus's wine, sleep with all his servant girls, and eat all of his meat and plunder his kingdom, right? But they're there to woo his wife, which I don't know why you would do that. That seems like a terrible idea, and it's not working. Penelope wants none of this. Penelope has, and Odysseus have a young son named Telemachus, who at this point is a young man because his father has been gone from home for 20 years, but he and has never known his father. He has heard the stories of his father, heard him extolled as a hero and held up as a paragon of manly virtues, which indeed he is. But Penelope and Telemachus have no idea if Odysseus is alive, let alone coming home. And they are stranded in their homeland, surrounded by dangers and temptations in the form of these suitors, right? So they need him to come home. And they are in a bind that's not just existential and psychological, but is very practical. The bind that they're in is that Penelope is caught between two competing duties. The first is that if her husband is coming home, she absolutely must be faithful to him. Because this is a time without, you know, for all of history, faithfulness in marriage is important. It is the bedrock of society, always. But in this particular case, because she is such a highborn woman and because she has one son, any incident of infidelity calls into question the entire inheritance and stability of the kingdom. It is a political question as much as it is a domestic one. And so she cannot take another husband if Odysseus is alive. However, if Odysseus is dead, she must take another husband. Because the kingdom has to go to, again, she's a prodigious leader in her own right, but she is a woman in a man's world, and the kingdom needs to go to a stable king. And Telemachus is coming to the age in which he can, with the right training and with the right help, take the throne. Now, the suitors don't like this. They want to get rid of Telemachus because if he claims his identity and claims his leadership over Ithaca, they're going to get booted. And they have a pretty good deal going on right now. So time is ticking. Penelope has been able to keep the suitors at bay, but it's been a really long time. They're getting restless. They're forcing the issue, especially because Telemachus is coming to the age in which if someone were to back him, he could stabilize the kingdom. So, but here's the problem with Telemachus. He is his father's son, but he has nobody to teach him how to be a man. His father is gone. He has the stories of his father, but he doesn't have any relationship with a worthy, noble man to teach him how to be an honorable leader. And as you will see, he has the longing for it, but the gap is in the practical presence of a mentor and a teacher. This is the problem of the Odyssey. This is why the Odyssey begins with what sometimes some scholars call the Telemachy, the first few books in which Telemachus is the main character. When Odysseus comes home, what will he find? Now, symbolically, allegorically, this is very profound. You can read the Odyssey with Odysseus as a Christ figure. The Lord coming home, and we, like Penelope and Telemachus, stranded in a world of passions, dangers, temptations, awaiting our Lord's return. You can also read this allegorically with Odysseus cast in the role of the soul making its way home to paradise, the return, the homecoming to the kingdom of God. And then Odysseus then becomes this kind of allegory for the soul as we follow his journeys and his return. both ways are very profound and important ways to read the Odyssey. And the great thing about Homer is you just keep reading it over and over again, right? And every time there's something a little bit deeper. But we're going to look here at the Telemachy, right? And we're going to cast our students as Telemachus in a world of suitors, with his mother to protect, his homeland to protect, waiting for the return of his father. And what he needs is help. Enter Athena, the divine guide. Now, Athena, as a Christian allegory, can be certainly understood as the Holy Spirit. She plays this role of divine helper, leading him into his true calling and his true identity. You can also look at Athena's role, which I'm going to walk you through here in a couple minutes, as an allegory of a teacher and a mentor. She does some things that are very powerful, very profound, and very relevant to us. First of all, Athena advocates for Odysseus in the opening pages of the Odyssey, in book one of the Odyssey. She urges her father Zeus to remember Odysseus, reminding him that Odysseus has been lost and he needs to come home. Odysseus has been away from home for 20 years. The first 10 years he was fighting in the Trojan War, and the second 10 years he was trying to make his way home over the wide dark sea, encountering dangers and temptations of his own. So Athena urges Zeus to remember him with these words. She says, quote, "But my heart breaks for Odysseus, that seasoned veteran cursed by fate so long." She resolves then to help him by ennobling his son. This is how she's going to help Odysseus right now. Later on, she's going to go advocate for him and help him in his journey. But in order to help Odysseus now, she goes to Ithaca to ennoble his son to be an honorable man worthy of his father. So she says to Zeus about Telemachus, she says, quote, "While I myself go down to Ithaca, rouse his son to a braver pitch, inspire his heart with courage to summon the long-haired Achaeans to full assembly. Speak his mind to all those suitors, slaughtering on and on his droves of sheep and shambling long-horned cattle. Next, I will send him off to Sparta and sandy Pylos, there to learn of his dear father's journey home. Perhaps he will hear some news and make his name throughout the mortal world." So she immediately acts. As soon as she makes this speech, she puts on her helmet. Where's that helmet? I'm not going to wear that. And she goes down immediately to Ithaca to help. So she disguises herself. And this is a really important part of the way the gods would reveal themselves to mortals, right? Because they didn't want to make full theophanies because there would be death by holiness all over the place. And so the gods would disguise themselves usually as people that are in relationship to the mortal that they are speaking to. So Athena disguises herself as Mentes. And in doing this, she does this for two reasons. One, to protect them from the dangers of theophany, the revelation of the god's glory, which should be too much for their frailty. Also, to test the mortal's response, because they didn't want the mortals then to just respond out of fear. They wanted to test them and see if they were worthy of the test that they were going to be given. Right? So she disguises herself as a man that Telemachus would respect. So she goes to the palace, and in order to understand the nobility of what comes next, I have to tell you a little bit about the Greek code of hospitality. The way that the Greeks thought about hospitality is so different from the way we do. It's not just like nice, it's not just this a lovely kind of meal like we had. This is a fantastic, beautiful hospitality. But the Greek code for hospitality was more fundamental than ours. It was a matter of survival because people didn't travel back then very often. And when they did, they were always constantly in danger. In real life, they were in danger because of, you know, like all the things that you'd be in danger for traveling on foot or by sea or whatever. And also in the epics, they're in danger from like angry, vengeful gods and monsters. So like there's problems with traveling. And so imagine then that you're going somewhere and you need a place to stay. There's no such thing as a hotel. You can't check in somewhere. So you are just exposed to the elements and to the potential of starvation and attack without being able to find a place to stay. So hospitality is core. It's fundamental to the Greek life. So there was a code that governed it. And that code was, let's say I'm going to someone's house, to a, like a village, like a tribe. And imagine this is the Bronze Age. So if you're picturing like Athenian city-states, don't. We're picturing like small villages. And so you would go to a place and you would look around for the home of somebody about the same social status as you are in your home. And you would knock on the door and you would be welcomed in. And the person would bring you into their home, and then they would offer you a meal and a bath. And then after the meal was completed, then upon the drinking of the wine and the eating of the meat, after your needs, your physical needs have been satisfied, then your host would say, tell me about yourself. Tell me the story of your life. Where have you come from? What do you need? Tell me about your father. Right? And so then they would tell each other stories. And then the host would offer gifts to help you along your way. And it was understood that nobody violated this code without dire consequences from gods and men, because it's radical trust. The code of Xenia hospitality was everything. Fundamental to Greek culture. So Athena, disguised as Mentes, comes knocking on the door of the palace. And the text tells us this: first by far to see her was Prince Telemachus. He opens the door, he welcomes her. Let me read to you. I love this passage. First by far to see her was Prince Telemachus, sitting among the suitors, heart obsessed with grief. He could almost see his magnificent father here in the mind's eye. If only he might drop from the clouds and drive these suitors all en route throughout the halls and regain his pride of place and rule his own domain. Daydreaming so, he sat among the suitors. He glimpsed Athena now, disguised as Mentes, and straight to the porch he went, mortified that a guest might still be standing at the doors. Pausing beside her there, he clasped her right hand and, relieving her at once of her long bronze spear, met her with winged words, "Greeting, stranger. Here in our house you'll find a royal welcome. Have supper first, then tell us what you need." And then he proceeds, Homer tells us, to go through the entire code. He sits Mentes down. He welcomes her. He feeds her. She makes sure that that her needs are met. And then he says, tell me your story. What do you need? Tell me about your father. Tell me how you got here. How do you happen to be traveling? What is your journey like? And they tell each other the stories of their lives. And Telemachus confides in the stranger how much he longs for his father. You can almost hear this young man's longing for help, for connection. Here is a man, of course it's Athena, but to his mind what he sees is a man he respects with a history with his father. And he tells him, tell me stories of my father. Have you heard any news? Now, here's what Athena could do at this point. Reveal herself in a grand theophany, slaughter the suitors, pick Odysseus up from the other side of the world and bring him home. The end. But she doesn't do that. Why? Because this isn't just about that. This is about a young man who doesn't know how to be a man. What Athena is doing here is much more existential than rescuing Telemachus from his immediate problem. She is the divine guide. She sees that the thing that he needs is mentoring in his masculinity. She sees this young man needs to know how to be a man, how to be a leader. He needs to be worthy of his father. He doesn't need an easy button. And so, after Athena has seen that Telemachus is a son worthy of her father, of his father, she helps him. As mentees, without revealing who she is, she gives him this advice. Quote, "For you I have some good advice, if you will accept it. Fit out a ship with 20 oars, the best in sight. Sail in quest of news of your long-lost father. Someone may tell you something, or you may catch a rumor straight from Zeus. Rumor that carries news to men like nothing else." Now, isn't that the truth? "First, go down to Pylos, question old King Nestor, then cross over to Sparta to red-haired Menelaus." Now, these are men who fought with and beside Odysseus in the Trojan War. Menelaus was the last to return home, except for Odysseus, of all of the warriors. And Nestor was the most respected mentor of the Achaeans during the war. So she sends him to the wisest man and the last man who fought beside his father. "Now, if you hear your father's alive and heading home, hard-pressed as you are, brave out one more year. If you hear he's dead, no longer among the living, then back you come to the native lands you love. Raise his grave mound, build his horses high, build his honors high with the full funeral rites he deserves, and give your mother to another husband. Then, once you've sealed those matters, seen them through, think hard. Reach down deep in your heart and soul for a way to kill those suitors in your home by stealth or in open combat. You must not cling to your boyhood any longer. It's time you were a man. And you, my friend, how tall and handsome I see you now, be brave, you too, so men will come to sing your praises through the years. It all rests with you. Take my words to heart." Do you hear how she ennobles him? She tells him who he is. She gives him a vocation that's not easy, that's right now beyond his strength and wisdom. He can't yet do it. But she sees in him that with help from her, he can. He's not ready to be a hero yet, but she sees he could be, but he can't do it alone. He is stranded in a sea of enemies without his father and his king. He needs guidance, both moral and practical. Go get a ship, go find out news from your father. You've never done anything like that before, but I'll help you. And then come back and clean house with all the lessons that you've learned along the way. This is what mentors do. This is very relevant to our age. Not just for the young men, for the women too. I don't have to tell you that we live in a world that does not provide the scaffolding around us within the culture to ennoble our students to await the return of the king. But they are not alone. We can imitate Athena. They need an Athena to ennoble them to overcome the dangers and temptations that surround them, to ask more of them than they can do right now. and then to equip them to do it. I think that's the role of a mentor. By the end of the Telemachy, Telemachus is a young man worthy of his father. Potential becomes reality through the intervening grace of a mentor and a guide. So how? How does she do it? There's a couple important things that she does that ennoble Telemachus. The first one is that she becomes invisible. This is a hard one for teachers. Right. Most of us become teachers because we got something to say. But a wise teacher is concerned with the becoming of our students more than ourselves. We let our egos die. Athena doesn't leave Telemachus in the first five books of the Odyssey. She's there with him. She doesn't leave him or forsake him, but she often hides herself from him. In fact, only twice does he know that Athena is there. Almost all the time she is in disguise, working behind the scenes. Telemachus responds to that speech I just read you with these words. He says, "O stranger," heedful Telemachus replies, "indeed I will. You've counseled me with so much kindness now, like a father to a son. I won't forget a word. But come, stay longer, keen as you are to sail." He wants her to stay. Her eyes glinting, Pallas declined in haste. "Not now. Don't hold me here. I long to be on my way." With that promise, off and away, the bright-eyed goddess flew like a bird in soaring flight, but left his spirit filled with nerve and courage, charged with his father's memory more than ever now. This always makes me think, how many of y'all have read Harry Potter? I'm crazy about Harry Potter. I know that that's controversial in these circles, but there's a main character that dies, and it is only after that character is gone that Harry can fulfill the role, the calling that he has on his life. We teachers exist to disappear at some point. But not out of relationship, just out of the visibility, out of the control, out of the management. In this crucial formative moment, she gives her full attention to Telemachus's journey of becoming, but she doesn't insist on being seen or recognized or getting glory for it. Now, she's a goddess, and I am telling you, the gods and the goddesses in Homer are very concerned with their own glory. They are not yet the Christian gods. But in this case, Athena is doing something beyond her own glory. She's doing it for his glory, the glory of him coming into his own. She knows her role. This isn't about her, it's about Telemachus and Odysseus, and by extension, the whole land of Ithaca. Because if we do not have young people who can walk on their own, we have our land will fall. That was true in Ithaca, it's true here, it's always going to be true. Teachers, we put our egos aside, right? Now, one thing I've never been able to do is define a teacher. I've had this conversation with Matt Bianco like 100 times. I don't know what a teacher is. I know what it is by analogy, or I can kind of apprehend by analogy. But if you were to ask me for a definition of a teacher, I can't do it. A teacher is like a guide. That's the best I can do, right? A teacher is a guide, a helper, a servant, a martyr. A mentor, right? A teacher is more powerful than a student, but the purpose of power is to bless. Athena shows us how to do that. Meno, you know, we were reading the Meno earlier today, asked the question, can virtue be taught? I don't know. I tend to think virtue cannot be taught in the sense that it can be passed on or bequeathed. But virtue is participatory. It must also, whether it can be taught or not, it must also be acquired by our own participation in it. We think often as teachers, I think, a little bit too much about what we can do and not enough about what our students can do and what we can empower and equip them to do by asking a little bit more than they're capable of and then showing them how to do that. The next day after Menti's advice, Telemachus calls an assembly, the first assembly in Ithaca since his father has been gone. He declares his intention to go search for his father, and there's a few people in the room who kind of give him a bit of a lukewarm, like, go get him, tiger. But most of the people in the room mock him for it. They mock him to his face and resolve to kill him behind his back. And this will happen to our students. After the assembly, he is discouraged and overwhelmed, and he prays for help. And immediately, Athena appears, not as herself, but in disguise, as Odysseus's trusted friend and companion, a man named, wait for it, Mentor. This is where we get the term, you guys. So when Elliot asked me to come and talk about teacher as mentor, I'm like, yeah, I mean, the talk writes itself. We get the term mentor from this relationship in the Odyssey. So Athena appears to Telemachus in immediate response to his prayer. Quote, Athena came to his prayer from close at hand, for all the world with Mentor's build and voice. Telemachus, you'll lack neither courage nor sense from this day on, not if your father's spirit courses through your veins. Now there was a man, I'd say, in words and actions both. So how can your journey end in shipwreck and defeat? Only if you are not his stock. Penelope's too. Says she, giving to him his own identity. This is who you are. Then I'd fear your hopes might come to grief. Few sons are the equals of their fathers. Most fall short. All too few surpass them. But you, brave and adept from this day on, Odysseus's cunning has hardly given out in you. There's every hope that you will meet your goal. Put them out of your mind, those suitor schemes and plots. They're madmen, not a shred of sense or decency in the crowd, nor can they glimpse the death and black doom hovering just at their heads to crush them in one short day. But you, the journey that stirs you now is not far off, not with the likes of me, your father's friend and yours, to rig you a swift ship and be your shipmate too. Now, home you go and mix with the suitors there, but get your rations ready. Pack them all in vessels, the wine in jars, and barley meal, the marrow of men's bones. I've never heard that before. I don't even eat that. Endurable skins while I make rounds in town and quickly enlist your crew of volunteers. Lots of ship and seagirt Ithaca, old and new. I'll look them over. Choose the best in sight. We'll fit her out and launch her into the sea at once. That's a lengthy quote. You're not supposed to do that as a speaker, but I'll tell you why. Because I want to walk you through what she's doing for him here. First, she reminds him of his true self. This is who you are. She instills him with hope that the challenges before may be too much for him, may feel too much for him now, but he can do it. He has the capacity to rise to what is required of him. She shows him the difference between virtue and vice. You are not like the suitors. Now, they're about the same age, some of them. It's remarkable that Telemachus has not become them. This is a testimony to his mother and the legacy of his father that surrounds him. But she teaches him there is a difference between that and you. She allows him to struggle and suffer to learn what he is capable of. She could intervene at any time. He is mocked, insulted, and underestimated. Her consolations still allow him to bear the burden of becoming a man. She does not tell him what she knows, that Odysseus is alive, that he is on his way home, that he is close, even that she was the one that intervened on Odysseus's behalf. And because she intervened with Zeus, Zeus has, as they are speaking, Zeus has sent Hermes to command Calypso to set Odysseus free so that he can come home. She knows all of that. But she does not tell him, because her goal is for something better for him, and he has to be able to rise to this. She provides encouragement and support as he learns to do it on his own. She provides practical help that Telemachus can't accomplish on his own, right? She finds and outfits the ship. She musters a crew. She makes sure that they have the proper rations. So what he yet cannot do, she does. And we as teachers and parents do this, right? There are certain things that we have to do for our students, that we teach them how to do, that they're not capable of doing on their own. But we do that only to the extent that is necessary so that they can rise upon that foundation. When my students come in and are like, I can't do my homework because it's too hard, I'm like, well, that's fine. Then you get a zero. That's your choice, right? But I think you can. How can I help? Right, we have to let them struggle to know what they can do. After the ship is outfitted, the journey begins. Quote, Telemachus climbed aboard. Athena led the way, assuming the pilot's seat reserved astern, and he sat close beside her. Of course, she is still mentor here. He doesn't know that this is the goddess. Cables cast off, the crew swing to the oarlocks. Bright-eyed Athena sent them a stiff blowing wind rippling out of the west, ruffling over the wine-dark sea, as Telemachus shouted out commands to all his shipmates, all running gear secure in the swift black craft. They set up bowls and brimmed them high with wine and poured libations out to the everlasting gods who never die, to Athena first of all, the daughter of Zeus with flashing sea gray eyes, and the ship went plunging all night long and through the dawn. So she's right there beside him. She's the one who makes the weather, right? She provides all this, and he doesn't know. And this, there is a loneliness to being a mentor, to being a wise mentor, right? You do these things, and they don't know what you're doing for them. There's a point later on in the Odyssey when Odysseus is having a conversation with Athena and he accuses her. Where have you been? He says to her. Like, I've been out suffering and struggling, like you've been on vacation. And she chides him for it. Like, I've been here the whole time. But that's sometimes how it goes, right? We have to have thick skins as mentors. Upon their journey, she makes the world bigger for him, not smaller. He's never been anywhere before. When his mother, Penelope, finds out he's gone, she begins to weep, right? She's a wise mother, but she's afraid that she's going to lose her son the same way that she has lost her husband. She wouldn't have let him go. But Athena is wise in that way too, and knows that the only way Telemachus can become a man is if people start treating him like a child. So she allows Penelope to be disappointed and afraid for the sake of the manhood of her son. Now, if that hits home, that hits home to me. I'm a mother of a 19-year-old boy. There's a cost to growth. And sometimes I think we are too prone to try to control and manage what is in the hands of our divine guide. There's always a risk. There's always a danger. That's what it means to live in a fallen world. We cannot make the world not fallen around and within our students. I really think that the most important lesson that we can teach our students is how to suffer with Christ. But I think out of our love, we try to protect them from suffering more than we try to ennoble them in it. But not Athena. She becomes smaller in his life as his world expands. She's there, but when they arrive in Pylos, he is met by Nestor, who, as I told you, was like the wise mentor of the Greeks. He was an old and respected warrior throughout the entire Trojan War, and indeed he lost his own son, who died in battle at Troy. And he welcomes Telemachus, immediately recognizes him. You look like your father. Can you imagine what that felt like to Telemachus? As he goes into the world, people recognize him as Odysseus's son. Immediately. Welcome him, ennoble him, show him and treat him with honor, whereas he has been scorned in his own home, right? And so Nestor welcomes him in and gives him good advice. And as Nestor gives him good advice, Athena becomes like a little bit smaller in his life as his world expands beyond his home in Ithaca. So you start hearing from mentor a little bit less and from Nestor a little bit more. Nestor has a son named Pisistratus who becomes really good friends with Telemachus. They ride chariots together. And he has a friend, a noble friend of his own age for the first time in his life because Athena led him there. And then as Pisistratus takes more of a place beside Telemachus, and Nestor takes more of a fatherly role and gives him wise counsel. Now Telemachus has a world beyond his home, a world in which he has a respected place as a man. This was all part of Athena's plan the whole time. And then at one point, as he gains what he needs, she begins to stand aside. She's still there. She's still helping. She's especially helping on the ship, working behind the scenes to orchestrate his practical needs at this point. But she withdraws herself from his visibility in proportion to his ownership and responsibility. And I think this is a really important thing as mentors. As we see our students and our children taking more responsibility, we back off just a little bit. We take up a little bit less room and give them a little bit more freedom. Also, then, overcoming dangers and temptations then instills him with heroic virtues, right? He becomes more courageous. He starts to speak with more confidence, especially as the people around him tell him he sounds like his father. He gains prudence. He starts to actually make plans himself. I want to go tomorrow to visit Menelaus. And when he learns the wrong lessons, she corrects him. There's a great moment. I didn't write down the quote. I think I remember what page number it is. Do you guys have like marked copies of your favorite books? All right, here we go. There's a point. When Telemachus kind of misses the mark. Never, Your Majesty, Telemachus countered gravely. He's speaking to Nestor. That will never come to pass. What you say dumbfounds me. Hope as I will, that day will never dawn, not even if the gods should will it so. He's saying, my father's probably never coming back. Telemachus, Pallas Athena broke in sharply, her eyes afire. What's this nonsense slipping through your teeth? Great thing for you to remember to say as a teacher. It's light work for a willing god to save a mortal even half the world away. And she goes on, when he's learning the wrong lessons, she intervenes and corrects him. Because of the trust that has been built between them. But Mentor gives way then to Pisistratus, to Nestor, to Menelaus. Intervention gives way to independence. Our final vision of Athena, what I call a backdoor theophany in the epics, when the gods are there in disguise, and then upon leaving, they leave kind of evidence somehow, like a trail of light or something like that, a change in the air that makes it clear to the mortals that they have just seen a god. After Nestor makes plans with Telemachus to go visit Menelaus, a mentor gives a final piece of advice. When you go to Sparta, do this. And then Nestor, none of them know that this is Athena. Nestor urges Mentor to stay. He's like, well, stay here and spend the night. We'll make a bed for you. Telemachus agrees to stay there and spend the night. And then the next day they're going to go to Sparta. But Mentor turns this down and says, I'm going to go back to the ship. I'm going to take care of everything at the ship. I'll see you tomorrow. And then as Mentor trails away, she reveals herself just a little bit. I'll read you the quote. It says, with that, the bright-eyed goddess winged away in an eagle's form and flight. Amazement fell on all the Achaeans there. The old king, astonished by what he'd seen, grasped Telemachus's hand and cried out to the prince, dear boy, never fear you'll be a coward or defenseless. Not if at your young age the gods will guard you so. Of all who dwell on Olympus, this was none but she, Zeus's daughter, the glorious one, his third born. From that point on, Athena has given him what he needs. He's set his course. He has what he needs to become a man worthy of his father. He hasn't met the last of his challenges, but she's provided a foundation for him and awakened in him a desire for the good and ennobled him by giving him the relationships that he needs, expanding his vision of the world, practically helping him enough with that behind-the-scenes work, given him hope, declared to him his true identity, and corrected him when he needed it. And from that point on, Telemachus can engage with the challenges before him so that upon his father's return, he is ready to fight beside him. This is the teacher as mentor. And really, it comes down, as all things do, to being like Christ. Right? The pagan tradition gives us what we need, and then we can fulfill that through the Christian story. So like Christ, for us to be mentors to our students, it takes a path of wisdom and a path of humility. And this is where the teacher as mentor, I think, becomes really, really important. Because mentoring, as many of the speakers have talked about today, kind of presupposes a relationship. Right? It carries with it this tacit or implicit understanding that in order to mentor somebody, you have to know them. You have to see them as a person. You have to recognize what they need. Now, if you have 1 million students in your class, you can't always do this, right? To the extent that we would want to. But in the classical tradition, this is one of the reasons why we converse and listen to our students so much. One time, we were having a discussion at a conference about what is a child, like what can we define what a child is. So somebody in the group said a child is a fool. And I like that, right? But a child is more than a fool. But a child is. And a fool has to suffer to be made wise, right? And this is what we can bring to them is that ennobling influence like Athena had for Telemachus. Wisdom, humility, courage. And practical help, right? So, glory to God for all things. Thank you very much.
Mm-hmm. That was The Divine Guide, Athena as Mentor by Heidi White. You've been listening to a recording provided by Gutenberg College. You can find more information about Gutenberg College on our website at www.gutenberg.edu. Any broadcast or retransmission of this recording without the express written permission of Gutenberg College and the conference speaker is prohibited. Thank you for listening.